All right, good day, everybody. Thanks for joining this, the 60th Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting. This is Dave Vellante, and I'll be your host for this session. The topic today is using sourcing strategies to modernize legacy systems. And we're very pleased to welcome our guest, Dave Robbins, who is the head of, or actually perhaps the former head of, global infrastructure and operations at NetApp. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
As most of you know, Wikibon Peer Insights are bi-monthly conference calls, and what we do here is we typically talk about how to apply technology to solve business problems. I'd like to ask that if you're not speaking on the call, if you could please mute your line. If you don't have a mute button, you can hit star 6 to mute and star 6 to unmute. That's star 6 mutes, star 6 unmutes. If you want to participate, just unmute your line. Everybody's welcome to do so and encouraged to do so. This call is being recorded and it's going to last 1 hour. And if you're on Twitter, please use the pound Wikibon hash so that it will auto-feed to our social media outlets. So with the logistics out of the way, I'd like to introduce the Wikibon community to Dave Robbins. Dave, it's great to have you here today. Thanks very much for agreeing to share your experiences with the Wikibon community. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, allowing me to do that.
So recently, in a discussion with Dave Robbins, he put forth a premise to us, and I'll paraphrase, and then we'll talk about it. So Dave suggested that we should not waste a recession, that the economic downturn is an opportunity to challenge current assumptions and drive legacy out of systems and modernize infrastructure to reduce operating expenses. And this is something that he led at NetApp. And Dave, we're going to ask you how the heck you paid for all that. But before we do, welcome again. I wonder if you could start by briefly telling us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay. So I've been in the industry for about 30 years. I've been in outsourcing for almost 20 of that. The last, since September of 05, so about 4 years, or August of 05, I've been at NetApp and initially came in and ran the infrastructure for almost 3 of those years, and then switched to a CTO role in the company, where I get to think a little bit more strategically about things rather than trouble tickets and those sorts of things. Just to be clear, we've done a lot of things in NetApp over the last 5 years that were part of what I would call an initial transformation that was required. Because NetApp simply hadn't invested in their IT infrastructure for a number of years. If you think about the post-2000 bust and how companies responded, oftentimes they starved their G&A organizations to survive and grow while they invested in products and services, and that's sort of what we did. So when I came in 2005, our first transformation was really to rebuild systems that were at their end of life or atrophying in other ways, out of capacity. And then most recently, as we talked before, I think last September created another such opportunity to say, instead of moving fast and refreshing what you have, which is what we did in 05, let's rethink. Let's think about how we do things going forward. And that's more the transformation. That's a journey we're just starting here at NetApp today.
Okay. So part of the premise is you can actually fund this transformation by using sourcing as a strategic weapon, right?
Sure. I think part of it has to do with many of us have been through, and certainly with my background in outsourcing, you go through a process where you evaluate, kind of start with personnel, and you look at maybe labor arbitrage by having some of your personnel offshore, but you maintain control of your operations, per se. Some people may go further towards outsourcing, but essentially what you're going through is a decision there based on people, right? So you're looking at what's core to my business or core to IT, and the clear things are usually around project management and architecture and the business relationship. And the less clear things that tend to fall into context are things around day-to-day operations or level one type support. So there's this kind of continuum of things that make sense for you to invest in and things that make sense to have other people do. So that's kind of the traditional way of looking at it. I think with technology advancing to where it has today, certainly with the advent of some real reasonable software as a service type applications, that companies need to take another approach, and with a similar vein, they need to look at what's the core application to my business, not just the people supporting it, but what do I need to run? For example, at NetApp, our key application is around customer support. We have a lot of automated intellectual property that actually exposes failures in devices before customers often even know about that. So that's a system that we'd want to continue to own and run and invest in. On the other side, if you look at content management systems or maybe even collaboration tools, you got to kind of look at those a little differently and say, is it really important that I run those systems? What value do I bring to the business? I think once you kind of put an approach around that, then you can start saying, well, who in the market might deliver that service to me, and can I actually drive OPEX improvements in my current model that I can then use to do other things that I really need to do for those more important systems.
Okay, so it sounds like you went through this sort of application portfolio assessment. Is that right? Or?
Yeah, and that's an ongoing thing. So there's some early things that you look at that clearly, things like, again, some of the collaboration tools. Is it really important that you run your own email system, for example? And I think we've targeted that. We haven't done anything to execute moving that out, but we're in process of looking at that and think that's a great opportunity.
So what are the dimensions of that decision? Is it cost, risk, value, or is it
Sure, it's all of that stuff. So, I mean, again, if you start to look at your application portfolio instead of just your, again, historically we've looked at people, process, and technology, and people tend to be, we tend to use labor arbitrage with either outsourcing or other lower-cost geos to address that. In this case, it's a different slice. It says, what are the actual nuggets in the overall portfolio that are important to the business? For example, what includes intellectual property? What are key business process supporters to our customers, those sorts of things. So as we go through that, we allocate, things that we're doing. For example, in our case, a lot of our marketing applications, things like some of our www web hosting and content management and a lot of the analysis that goes on around the website hits, that's all sourced. As well as a community site. That allowed us to do two things. One is respond very quickly to the business needs and let the marketing team get what they needed as fast as they needed it, but also kind of carve that out of the IT budget and shrink it in the process. So it was that was some of the early wins. And I think that's the other thing that people need to look at is sourcing gives you an opportunity to take some cost out, but it also gives you the ability to be more agile.
So let's look at those. So let's talk about the first one first. So you're taking essentially fixed cost out of the business. I mean, can you quantify that just even in percentage terms from starting point to where you are now and what the impact was?
In terms of the marketing set of applications, I don't have those numbers on the top of my head, so I couldn't quantify it for you. In their case, it was probably more important to be agile. I don't know if you recall, but a year ago we relaunched our brand, and there was a lot of activity that needed to take place, and our IT organization simply didn't have the capacity to do it. So we went to a software as a service sort of a model for all that, and it got us to where we needed to be as quickly as we needed to be there.
Okay, so is it should practitioners assume that they can? I mean, can they realistically assume that they can pay for such a transformation by sucking fixed cost out of the business and variabilizing those costs, or are you really on a sort of a testing ground here?
Well, I think we're all all IT organizations are more testing than have a proven set of cases they can point to. I think that the goal, and you just touched on it, is how can you move from a capital committed cost to a variable cost that's OPEX-based only. And the problem with IT budgets over the years, if you can look at anybody's data, and they'll show that particularly in the infrastructure area, somewhere between the high 60 percentages to the mid 70 percentage points, are all fixed cost. And the reason for that is, the fixed costs associated with data centers, leases for equipment, maintenance, software maintenance, and capital costs for either data centers or servers or networks, et cetera. And those things typically have a 3 to 5 year kind of bleed out. Worse, if you're implementing an application like an ERP application, it's not untypical to see those capital costs for implementation to be north of $30 million, and those typically have a 7 year kind of back end from a depreciation standpoint. So the idea here is how can I make more of my operational budget that variable OPEX, as opposed to this guarantee that I'm going to have to realize that depreciation for the next 3 to 7 years. So it's a big part of solving the problem in year two and year three by letting the depreciation on your existing commits bleed out and variabilizing your budget.
So, okay. So, in fact, I wonder if others have seen sort of similar, we've seen these metrics, but I'd be curious as to what others are seeing. 60 to 70% actually sounds conservative in terms of fixed cost, right?
Well, yeah, I've seen them as high as 80, but I was trying to hit in the...
Yeah, I mean, what's a reasonable, rule of thumb there? Any other thoughts? Any input on the call? I mean, what are you guys seeing out there in terms of percentage of costs that are fixed versus variable in typical IT budgets?
Yeah, Dave, it's Mike Versace. Hey, Dave, and I think just thinking back to the practitioner days, I've seen the numbers really in the 80 to 85% fully loaded. When you consider on the fixed side, when you consider the all-in personnel, hardware, software, and even some of the sourcing costs associated with that. So just on the number of 60 to 70, I think they are conservative, and what I've seen is in the 80 to 85% range.
So you always hear CIOs talk about how they're going to transform and change those percentages, and I'm going to push you a little bit, Dave. I mean, maybe without divulging specific percentages, but maybe you can talk even anecdotally about, have you actually been able to eat away at whatever that, the pre-transformation percentage was, or are you just sort of scratching at the surface here?
Well, I think... So you got to realize that when you implement things because of the commitments you've already made, you can't change things on a dime. So transformation of the budget from one that's fixed to one that's more variable has to recognize the commitments that have already been made. In our case, we implemented SAP system about a year and a half ago for CRM. We were fortunate in that our ERP system just kind of bled off the depreciation cycle recently. But the point is you've got a backlog. And again, in 2005, we implemented a lot of new systems to solve capacity and availability and reliability issues. So, we're just coming up upon the point where some of those things are starting to look like they're going to tail off, and we're at decision points where we'll decide to do things differently. And as we, as the necessity to refresh or build or buy come about, we have an applied set we have a process that we go through to say inside or outside. And we believe that we're going to impact our budget over the next 3 to 5 years somewhere in the order of magnitude of changing the fixed part by about 20% or so is sort of our target.
So by changing the fixed part 20%, you mean lowering it 20 percentage points, or
exactly? Okay, and those will be done through mostly sourcing decisions.
So hypothetically, if you're at, let's say, 70%, you'd want to take that percentage down to 50%, a 50-50 mix. Not that those are your numbers necessarily, but.
Right, somewhere around that sort of a change, yes. And it's going to rely partially on the maturity of some of the offerings that we look as we've mapped our portfolio to, or as we are mapping our portfolio and looking at when things need to be remediated or updated, and then what the sourcing decisions are going to be. It's going to depend on the maturity of the market to source a solution in a way that actually gives us better value.
So do you think this is a permanent shift in thinking, or is it we going to kind of go back to normal when the economy rebounds?
I think it's permanent, and I think once it starts, it'll continue to snowball. And I think, my view anyway is that if you look at software as a service in particular, as new companies or small companies launch, they may never have what we would think would be a formal IT department. They'll have more of a sourcing department.
So you're suggesting that the role of IT shifts pretty dramatically in that?
Over time, yeah. I mean, there's a long runway, but I think over time, IT is going to look very different than it does today.
Can you share with us your thoughts on how IT looks and what that means for practitioners?
Well, I think the focus needs to move more towards being much closer to the business in terms of business process and understanding what the problems are that need to be solved, and kind of stepping out of the role of once I see a requirement, I need to build something to meet the requirement, and more into a role of how do we solve this problem together and what's the best way to do that. Some companies still do a pretty good job at that today, but I think none are really where they need to be. But I think getting closer to being a part of the business, making a defined and optimized procurement strategy, whether it's with your own IT organization or whether it's with a software as a service or a cloud provider or an outsourcer, needs to be much much more business oriented decision than it is today. I think over time, IT organizations, because of that, will have to develop, their whole procurement philosophy, their strategy, and their competence. So you'll see, in my view, you'll see a strengthening of the business relationship skills in IT, and you'll see a strengthening of how do you actually procure these services, how you negotiate the terms, and then there'll be a set of I think emerging skills that aren't quite there yet today around the technology integration. How do clouds federate? How do I get my data in and out of the cloud? How do I retire a SaaS provider when I want to move to another one? And what is security models look like and those sorts of things. So I think there's a whole technology growth area that's more focused on the integration and collaboration piece, and then there's the procurement and then business skills. I think those three areas will evolve pretty dramatically.
Well, that's good. Thank you. I'd like to come back to that. Before we do, I want to talk about the primary motivation here, which is you were suggesting the flexibility that this gives you. Is that why you feel like this is a permanent shift? First question, and then secondarily, why didn't this happen before, let's say in the last downturn?
So the why didn't it happen before is, in my view, because there weren't reasonable technologies to exploit. You know, I don't think we've ever been at a point where you had the opportunity to go look at building your own HR system or go into Workday or a NetSuite for ERP or somebody else. Those services just weren't there. Or if they were there, they were so young, nobody would want to do anything, more than a test case with them. But I think we're seeing some enormous wins, in particular with, I'll use Workday again. We don't use them here, but you look at some, like Flextronics just moved an enormous user base onto Workday, and they did it on time and under budget for probably what would be half their operating cost to run an HR system. So those things are going to get more, those opportunities will continue to evolve and mature. And so I think it's going to, we're going to have to get smart about how we do this. I'm sorry, I forgot your first question.
It related to the driver here, which I think you intimated, at least I inferred, was the business flexibility.
So the flexibility piece is something that, certainly if you look at companies today, let's take a worst-case example. Let's say a company has, 20,000 employees, and they hit an economic wall, and they've got to go ahead and spin down 3,000 people. There's no relief on any of the systems that they deployed to probably support a 20,000-person company, right? Because IT organizations never build the capacity for what you need today. They build capacity for what you're going to need 3 years from now. So if you're in growth mode and you're looking at where my trajectory is and trying to get ahead of that, you've basically deployed capacity in advance. And a lot of the assets aren't very well utilized. So you end up with a kind of a bigger back end than you really need to support today's business, and it gets absolutely worse in any downturn. So the need for agility is there, and it's always been there. It's just we haven't had reliable means to address it in the past.
So at a macro level, you're building for peaks, and then if there's a fundamental change in the overall demand, you're stuck with the capacity for that peak. And at a micro level, you can probably see that from day to day or week to week, month to month basis.
I mean, worse, it's not only peak, it's peak over time, right? So let's give a worst case example. You know, when I was in the outsourcing business and we sized HR systems, we used to look at a 3-year growth forecast, and then we'd assess what the peaks were along the way. And the systems were defined in terms of their capacity for the peaks between 1 and 3 years. Now, if you look at HR, that's pretty troubling because HR is a relatively benign application most of the time, but during enrollment, you know, that one time a year that your employees have to enroll, it gets hit pretty hard. The rest of the time, the asset's, you know, not very well utilized. So that's kind of a worst case scenario, and that's why I like that as a good example as a SaaS sort of a model.
So I want to explore this a little bit. I heard some star sixes, I think, but before we, so what I want to do is talk a little bit about the, you mentioned cloud. I want to understand where you are on the cloud maturity model and how you envision IT organizations, managing that external versus the internal. But before we go there, I just want to open it up a little bit and see if anybody has any comments or questions or other thoughts.
This is Nick Allen. Could you cite some other examples besides HR?
I mentioned the collaboration suites. That's another one where you tend to make pretty large investments if you're a fair-sized company, whether it's an email or SharePoint services or what have you. And I think you're seeing a lot of interesting things, whether it's Google or whether it's Microsoft or others. Certainly there's good reasons to have those things in-house, but generally, you know, your IT organizations are risk-adverse. An email is a mission-critical app. So you tend to deploy, overcapacitize it and make sure it's available. It turns out to be a poorly used asset in some cases. And then if you have a downturn, you have no way to adjust your investment.
So why not just outsource the email? What's stopping you?
We're looking at options to do that right now. But, the point is that what is the right set of services? So, for example, you don't want to inhibit, if somebody's a startup company and all they need is email, you know, that's an easy decision. Where you're a mature company, you know, several billions of dollars in revenue, and you're thinking about, well, how does unified communications, how does presence, how does shared documents, how does email, how do all these things play together from a collaboration perspective? And I think those solutions are a little less mature as a grouping of solutions in the market today. So we're looking at those to see what's out there right now. We're in discovery phase. But, if you're small and you only need one thing, it's an easy decision. If you need the collaboration and you're, you know, a global company with lots and lots of people and a lot of history in terms of documents. You know, for example, we have over 1 million documents in our SharePoint site. So, you know, we need to look pretty carefully about how we source that.
Right. So it's not just the application; it's the data that brings challenges and risks. Is that right?
Right. And the more integrated you want the applications, so I think the more challenge it is to find providers that do that level of integration.
Okay, so I come back to, you know, we were using these sort of rules of thumb before, 80% fixed cost versus variable, and, you know, or 70 to 80, and the goal would be less than 50 to 50. You know, what kind of realistic time frame should practitioners think about actually getting there, and how do you get from point A to point B?
So I think, You know, the old adage, your mileage may vary. I think there's a number of factors here. I think one is you have to do a careful analysis of what's in your portfolio. What are those things that are truly context to your business? And they're important, but, you know, hey, somebody else may run them a heck of a lot better than you do for a lot less money. So kind of go through that sorting. I think the other thing you have to look at is once you identify those, what's your current commitments? All right, so if you're going through the exercise now and you just rehosted your entire environment last week, then you probably got a big timeline before you can affect any change. So it's important to look at what you believe is context, and it's important to look at what your commitments are. And, you know, if you do decide to move something to more of a sourced model, is it possible to reallocate the equipment that makes up that capital and avoid some other purchase once you do some transition? But you have to click through this and say, what are your own commitments and what are your own beliefs around those, or at least those two dimensions?
Right. Okay.
That'll dictate the timeline, actually, right?
Right. Right. Well, what about you guys? I mean, when do you see yourselves getting there? Is this over the next 5 years? Is this a 10-year journey?
So, you know, we've been working pretty closely with our executive team on a 5-year plan, but we think we'll probably more accurately target something like a 3-year plan to get to a better place. So, you know, there's recognition in our case with our executives that, you know, this is a journey that we didn't get into, or this is a destination we didn't get to in a day, and we're not going to get out of it in a day, and it's going to take some thought and some work over time, but we're currently looking at that 3 to 5 year kind of a window. You know, when you think about it, depreciation and leases and investments tend to be in somewhere in that range.
Okay. So I want to talk about this notion of cloud computing. You brought that up, and we can use a fairly broad definition, using sourcing as sort of a proxy for cloud. But I'm curious as to where you see yourselves on that cloud computing maturity model and kind of where you want to go, and specifically how you will allocate applications, move applications between internal and external, and how will you decide to do that? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Right. So in terms of how we'll move between, I think we're more focused initially on how do we delineate what's out and what's in. So in other words, there are things that we'll clearly want to have out, and there are things that we'll clearly want to have in. So in terms of federated or data movement or integration, we're trying to minimize those things right now. So let's say if there's 3 apps that were integrated, maybe it makes sense to move all those 3 apps to the cloud as opposed to one of them and try to do some back-end integration. As far as our cloud perspective, it's really to look at it, and I think, again, starting with my comment about skills and the IT organization moving towards more business orientation, I think firstly it's more about support can we give the business in a more agile way that'll drive our cost points out. So software as a service tends to make, and that's, to me, is cloud, right? That's, and to me, first of all, cloud to me is roughly defined as infrastructure as a service, which is basically the old utility model that we've all known for a long time that had never really got off the ground, but highly virtualized infrastructure, essentially. And then the middle tier is the platform as a service layer, and the top tier essentially is software as a service, is how it's consumed. As an IT person, I think we'd rather buy more things at the software as a service layer. However, I think that there's an opportunity when you look at large footprints, I'm talking multiples of thousands of servers, if you look at, how can I get to a unified architecture that it wouldn't matter where the servers were, in particular with regard to test and development systems. So if you look at your backlog of servers, you might find in your data center, you could find a lot of things, and probably one of which is there's probably 20% that aren't doing anything, and nobody knows what they do anymore. But what you might find is that a good percentage of every application ecosystem is in dev and test, or what I would call pre-change control environments, things where the application admins are doing unit testing or sandboxes or what have you. We're looking right now at several providers around how can we potentially reduce the amount of outlay that we have for systems and the related network ports and power in the data centers and so on by using a more generic kind of infrastructure as a service play for some number of servers to support our application portfolio. That would be much more, would be much better utilized than trying to have, you know, a set for every application ecosystem in the building. Does that make sense? So my point is, we either want to buy servers or piece parts at the bottom so that we don't have to, on an as-use basis, so we don't have to buy those assets because they're only used some of the time anyway. And then the top end, we'd rather buy business process support type software as a service applications.
Okay, so you're saying for infrastructure, you want to identify those areas where you can variabilize those costs. Is that right?
Right. So, I think, and part of that is it's, in the reality of today's cloud is that most of what you can buy is Intel-based, for example. So if you've got a big power or a big Spark-based infrastructure, you probably wouldn't look at those architectures. But over time, you might want to move to more of an Intel sort of unified architecture and use that to help variabilize your commitment to assets.
Okay, so it's not, you're not putting forth a strategy or a scenario where you're moving stuff actively between internal and external. It's more choosing what goes in, what stays in, what goes out, and pretty much operating the business that way.
I think initially that's the way you weighed in.
Right. Okay. So that implies that you'll identify opportunities to variabilize costs, aggressively pursue those either through, you know, infrastructure or software as a service if in the case of business process, and then the stuff that you'll leave internal are the things that you need control of, and it's kind of business as usual there. You'll over-provision and, you know, the capacity plan and worry about peaks and so forth, or there
well, so on the inside, there's kind of, in our case, there's two categories of things that we'll focus on. For those things that we deem we need control of, we want to run, we want to manage, they'll fit into, basically our own private cloud, if you will. Now, we have some P-Series, for example, for our big CRM application and so on. Those will pretty much remain as they are, and we'll deal with them because they're very, very specific, very mission critical, and they're very well utilized, to be frank. I mean, I think when you have the situation where you have well-defined apps like that, you can optimize those fairly well. In the other spaces where, again, probably more out to the peripheral applications that are either Windows or Linux-based, we'll build more of a cloud-like infrastructure. In fact, we're doing that today in Raleigh in our new data center that we just commissioned there. And everything's virtual. Everything's provisioned or will be provisioned in an automated way. And we're looking at several incremental kinds of tools around automation in that space. But the idea is that what you have inside that you need to keep will look more like a cloud, and what you use outside will be a cloud.
Okay, so this term you use, private cloud, you're using that as an internal, highly virtualized and optimized, you know, set of applications running under.
Right, and the idea there is drive up asset utilization and get to real-time type provisioning sorts of techniques. So you solve the agility issue by using these techniques, and you also get your asset utilization up. It's still a pretty sad state of affairs, I think, in most shops with regard to asset utilization.
Okay, so these are the high-value, mission-critical, but probably high-cost applications that you need to optimize.
Right.
How important is it that you have, you know, consistency and common governance and compliance and security and the ability to sort of define and monitor SLAs across those sort of internal and external resources? Is that important?
I think it's very important. And again, that's, you know, if you look at how IT organizations or do not roll up, and I think, again, there's a lot that don't roll up SLA type metrics today. But as you work with this kind of blended service model, you have to determine how to do that. You have to look at the service commitments and service levels you get from your source providers, and you have to certainly do the same internally. And organizations vary pretty widely in their maturity around being able to do that. I've had people, for example, say, well, if I move something to the cloud, I'm not going to get the security I want, and I'm not going to get the service levels I want. So you start to ask them the questions of, well, what are your service levels now? And basically you hear crickets a lot of the time because they don't really have a service level commitment. If you look at, are you ISO 27K certified or are you SAS 70? Well, no, they're not. But the service provider they're saying won't give them what they need is all of those. So I think in many cases it's a way to actually move the bar up in terms of what service levels you're going to get. The reporting and how you roll it all together for the executives I think is a big area to look at as well. Because I think alignment of what the checks are being written for to the business value that they return is more important than ever.
Yeah, so a lot of this you're saying is sort of psychological effects of or fear factors of putting things out where the cloud providers actually may have better security or service levels.
They may. I mean, you look at, if somebody's got a SAS 70 Type 2 and they're ISO 27K certified, and somebody's telling me that they're not going to afford the security they can internally, I'd say, what are you smoking? I mean, that's fear. But there's no rational justification for it.
So I'll tell you what I'd like to do here, Dave. I know you can't make our after call where we define sort of the research notes that we write. As most of you know, we take these calls as sort of a collaborative means to catalyze research, and we produce 6 or 7 research notes after a call like this. I want to give folks one more chance to ask questions, but then I'd like to look at what the implications here are for, and the actions, I'm looking for one action, and maybe we can talk about amongst ourselves, I'm not just putting this on you, Dave, but the CIO action, the technology integration action, what organizational issues we need to think about, what other asset management things we need to consider in the time we have remaining. But let me just stop again, *6 if you're muted and you want to unmute. Are there any other questions for Dave or comments from others? Give you a last chance to do that.
This is David Flyer. I've got a couple of questions, if I may. If I start with one, if you look at the cost difference between providing your own infrastructure, assuming you can utilize it moderately effectively, and outsourcing it, it usually is more effective to put in your own. At the moment. But obviously there is greater flexibility in terms of being able to turn things off if you put it outside. Assuming that premise is true, how do you judge how much you outsource and who pays for the difference in cost? How do you identify that?
Well, I don't necessarily believe or agree that own is always the best choice. I think there's certainly
the cheaper. I didn't say the best.
The cheaper. I meant cheaper. I mean, I've read the McKinsey study that came out, and I was at the Uptime Institute, and I walked over to the guy after, and I said, "What were you guys even thinking?" And he said, "What?" And I said, "Why would anybody choose to just move their infrastructure to a cloud?" And he said, "Well, what do you mean?" And I said, "Well, my view is that people are going to opportunistically use infrastructure as a service around their dev test kits, and they're going to buy software as a service to support business applications." He said, "Yeah, you're probably right." And I said, "Well, what's the point of your study?" it didn't make any sense to me at all what he presented at Uptime Institute. He said, "Well, we wanted to throw something controversial in because there's a lot of really hype around cloud, but wanted to take a different look at it." And I said, "Well, I could have told you what the results were afterwards. If you assume that you need 100% server-for-server replacement in the cloud, you're starting with a flawed assumption." So, you know, the fact is, if you looked at shops today, average server utilization in the ecosystem apps, and what I mean is not the top 10% that run the company, but the other 90% that are providing a support role, and the dev test environments, average utilization is still hovering below 5 or 8%. Some are down around 2. So anybody says, that doesn't make sense to try to move that to somebody else who can give you a more highly utilized platform, you can have or quarter the number of servers you have if you look at it from that perspective. And I think that's the objective.
Why couldn't you do that internally?
Why would you want to?
Okay, all right. So that's,
when somebody else can do it, I mean, you can invest in all the tools and everything, and maybe some moderate investment does make sense, right? So where you just determine things are need to be private, and but you do want to increase utilization, you'll make some small investments around that. But when you're looking at driving asset utilization up or not putting any more assets beyond a certain point in your data center, then you want, you know, let somebody else give you only the one CPU instead of the four that you have allocated. The sad fact is also is that when people virtualize often, they virtualize their real virtual or physical to virtual with the same characteristics, right, to make the application people happy. So if you got a quad core with so much memory, et cetera, they make the virtual asset the same. Well, the reality is the most the host that's going to, if you have a bunch of those in one host, 10 or 20 or whatever the number might be, you're going to spend a huge amount just time slicing to give those people, to give those assets access to what you've allocated to them, and the reality is they probably only needed one core because the asset was only 2% utilized. So, again, when people try to do it inside, they have to get over those kind of intellectual roadblocks that I bought four here because I had four in production. I only needed one here. So, you know, how do I do that and figure that all out? And sometimes that stuff's easier to buy than it is to do.
So how did you deal with that, Dave? I mean, I think I heard you say don't when you're going to virtualize, don't make V equal P. You know, take advantage of it so you can drive utilization up. So how did you placate your application developers in that scenario?
Well, you know, in some cases we haven't fully placated them yet. So, you know, we give them, and we virtualized firstly in Solaris and P-Series where it was a little bit easier to do because of our footprint. But, you know, you build trust over time, right? So we deployed Solaris 10 containers for an application and that people were against it, and we said, well, this is what you need to do, and they used it, and they said, this is actually faster than our old test environment. So you got to get everybody to the same place. And you know, you got to work through it. There's no magic answer.
Okay, good. All right, can we talk about folks? Can we talk about the actions here? Are there any other pressing comments or questions that folks have?
I had one other that if I may just ask another premise question. You've emphasized a lot the reduction in operational cost, but you haven't talked about the enablement of applications or better applications for the business a little bit with software as a service maybe. With the advent of convergence and clouds, it would seem that there was a greater opportunity to reduce costs by driving efficiency between businesses rather than currently where almost all the investment is driving investment, they're driving efficiency within the business. Would you agree with that premise, or do you think that premise is important? And if you do, what are you doing to help enable better applications for the business as a whole?
So you're talking about interoperability between multiple companies? Is that what you're...
Yeah.
So we haven't been, it hasn't been a focus point for us to do that. Most of our integrations, I do have two kind of comments on it. One is most of our integrations have been more direct around our contract manufacturing or field sales teams, et cetera. I think one opportunity of where we're looking to better enable kind of field is we're actively moving to a SaaS model for our Salesforce tools. So in essence, right now our global model is for the field, for whether you're a third-party vendor or a NetApp employee, you actually come back to our Sunnyvale site, actually Sacramento site, to access our Siebel environment. And we're looking at moving to a bit more modern and bit more effective model to enable the field. But that's more direct kind of partners or field personnel acting as or partners acting as field personnel. So we think there'll be some value there. We're in the process right now, by the way, of untangling some pieces in that system that are our IP around some configuration and getting it more to a very generic Salesforce automation kind of environment, which should be a lot easier for the field to use. So I think in that sense, we're trying to get more ease of business use. I think another comment that I'd like to make is that it goes back to security and the business-to-business connections that we've all sort of accommodated over the years. And I think it kind of goes something like this. If you look at the landscape of networks, especially in high-tech companies about, you know, 5 or so years ago, we found most people had this philosophy of, well, I'm going to have a real hard kind of exterior. I'll put my intrusion detections and firewall systems out there, and then I'll have a DMZ where I maybe bring vendors through, et cetera, or B2B type connections. But what's really happened, I think, over the years is because of the fluid nature of bringing new partners on or using a contract development staff somewhere else, you end up with lots of connections into your soft center of your security model. And I think you know, the approach of this interaction between business needs to be looked at in concert with what the current hardness or current security model is for your networks and your systems inside your company. And I think that plays into whether it's a cloud strategy or whether it's business to business. But I think that's a weakness that's evolved over time.
I think that's very true. Thanks.
Okay, so Dave, I'd like to ask you, with our assistance here, we can brainstorm this a little bit in the few minutes we have remaining. Thinking about some advice for your fellow practitioners, well, let's start with the CIO action. I mean, if you're talking to and what I'd like to do is really focus on the one most important action that we think practitioners should take as a result of what we heard today. So, if you're talking to your fellow CIOs, what would you tell them that they should do to sort of prepare for this, or what action should they take to really take advantage of what we've been discussing today?
You know, the one thing that when I talk to folks, I say is that you should challenge everything. Just as a de facto, nothing gets through as usual anymore. You know, I don't care whether it's a simple asset refresh or whether it's an upgrade in your ERP system or whatever it might be. I think challenge everything it should be a mantra. As you guys know, you saw me, I think, and the reason we're talking here is I did the presentation on Green IT. You know, we haven't built data centers in 5 years with raised floors. You know, why are you continuing to run fiber channel when you can converge everything on one wire? Those are simple infrastructure things, but without asking those questions and challenging every single thing that goes on, it's fair to say that business as usual could continue and continue to build that backlog of fixed costs in your IT organization. So very simply, I think challenge everything should be the mantra.
Okay, so why can't we do this differently, or why are we doing it this way? How could we do it differently? What would it mean is really what you're suggesting.
Yeah, is there something new? Is there a better way? I mean, just because you built data centers with raised floors 30 years ago, is that still the best way to build them? And the answer is clearly no. But people build them like that every day. So, I mean, the point is that we need to create the challenge in the intake process that says, you know, why are we doing this, and can we do it more smartly?
You mentioned before technology integration, and we like to, you know, have an action for, maybe call it the CTO action, but there's always a technology integration action that comes out of our calls. Can you talk a little bit about that and what you would advise there?
Well, again, relative to sourcing, I guess, you know, the action would be to really look at your portfolio of applications. And to me, I think the ones you cull out pretty quickly are the standalone apps. You know, if they have no integration, then why are you doing them? They're obviously important to somebody, but are they important to the entire enterprise? And might there be a better way? So I think things that do not have intellectual property, things that do not have integration, are the first things to be looked at. And those that do, I mean, you heard me mention Salesforce. We actually looked at apps and said, well, you know, Salesforce is a pretty common set of features, managing pipelines and contacts and that sort of thing. But the configuration of our products isn't. Well, why are they together? Let's take those apart and optimize that. And that's a better investment than continuing to upgrade Siebel, as an example. So again, where you have them, so first of all, identify the ones you clearly have no integration, and I would imagine there's probably a fair amount. Look at those, and then secondly, look at the ones that say, these are generic functions, but we've made it non-generic. How can we go back?
So look at disintegrating some of the ones that you've overcomplexified.
Right. So, I mean, for example, with our Siebel, you know, we could have done a $25 million upgrade to our Siebel application. But let's not do that. Let's spend a few million dollars to take out the parts that are unique to us, and then let's use software as a service to deliver something, and we can move, you know, the support personnel, the data center hardware, the networks, all that stuff somewhere else, and optimize that around people that really know how to run Salesforce automation.
How about as it relates to organizational issues that you encountered with this? We talked a little bit about some of the application development guys and placating them, which is, you know, never easy, and they're important folks. What's the primary organizational challenge and action that sort of you think comes out of this?
Well, you know, in many ways, when you start to, you know, start to implement this model, it really does break your existing organizations and, you know, the traditional organizations of, you know, infrastructure and business applications and so on, where people tend to fall, need to be less oriented around those technology things and more around sustaining or kind of operations and kind of the engineering or project portfolio work. So you start to, you know, you need to start to look at your organizations a little differently, because you want to, you know, essentially we're used to want to have a control of something. You want to actually delegate control now. You want to make sure the right person is making the right decisions, whether it's with a SaaS vendor for something or whether it's to get a new virtual server. Certainly you'd like those choices and those decisions to be made lower in an organization with as little overhead as possible.
Right, so organizing so that you can make decisions around whether it's procurement or how you're managing, you know, an application with a SaaS vendor, et cetera, mm-hmm. pushing that down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe breaking the existing silos.
Well, you know, governance, you know, think about it operationally one way and then governance is another. So you know, the way that IT teams execute needs to change to model this, but also the governance process needs to be put in place to make sure that as you look at the demands, at least the way we look at demands is we go through a process with a set of groups that are interested in their business unit, and we get their requirements and work with them what the right solutions are going to be. And I think that governance process needs to be moving with the mind of how can I implement the best operationally kind of optimized portfolio with the quickest, you know, with the most agility and flexibility as I go forward, as opposed to assuming, you know, we always build it.
How about your vendors? I mean, what would you tell your vendors as a result of the changes that are coming in your organization? What do you want to see them do?
Well, it would depend on the type of vendor, but I think if you the closer you get to hardware or infrastructure, you'd want more of a capacity on demand sort of a model, or pay-for-use sort of a model. When it gets to the bigger software applications, I think jury's out on those guys. I think one of the challenges of going into the cloud is that if vendors still are expecting big license cost per core and then big maintenance fees, that's the direction that needs to change over time. I know that a lot of vendors heard that with a utility model, But cloud is going to put more of a chokehold and emphasis on trying to make that happen. But that's a problem. And if your acquisition costs are still governed by the highest price ISV, then, you know, it's kind of, it gets to be moot.
Yeah, right. And then finally, the last one we look at is we call GRS, getting rid of stuff. I presume what you got rid of is a bunch of fixed costs. But is there an action around getting rid of stuff, things you can unplug as a result of all this?
Well, I think it's, you know, sure, there's things that that will unplug over time, and we have already. I think the other side of that is focus on what's important, right? Because if you look at your portfolio, I think if you start to look at things that aren't integrated, those tend to be probably less valuable, less important applications. And if you look at it on the other end, it's hard for them to see the middle where there might be some overlap. But if you look at both ends, you can pretty much see that. So if something's really important to the company, it has your intellectual property, it runs your day-to-day business, it takes care of your customer base, you know, those things are things you ought to be focusing on, and certainly the business wants you to. And then all the cats and dogs stuff at the other end of the spectrum, they don't understand why you spend so much time on those or how much of the fixed costs are actually associated with those. So I think this categorization of what's important and what's not is pretty important, because not only does it help you get rid of stuff, but it helps you focus and align to the business.
Yeah, so you're saying if you pay attention to the things of value, the rest will take care of itself almost.
Yeah, it'll help. Certainly help.
Yeah, it'll help. Right. Okay, good. Well, thank you. We did the after call, so that's fantastic, and pretty much out of time here. Let's see. We've got a couple minutes. Any other final questions for Dave while we have him?
Yeah, I had two. One is talk about aligning IT with business better. Organizationally, what do you recommend?
Well, you know, we're going through that process right now. I think, you know, what we've done historically has worked okay, but we're trying to improve upon it. I think aligning with the business starts out with executive alignment, right? So that's usually at the center of the company somewhere. You make sure you have the right decision makers lined up making the decisions. In our case, we have a two-level governance process, and I would say actually maybe a third. But the two levels, first of all, are one level is based on our business units. So we actually have VPs or above at the business unit level that are actually helping to articulate what the requirements are and what the IT capabilities are to address those requirements. We aggregate those, and then we go to a more strategic committee that's cross business unit, and there we go through prioritization and alignment. So at that level, you know, clearly we're getting company-wide alignment of what needs to be done. And then above that, we actually have executive staff participation, where we'll go in and share with the COO and CEO, et cetera, what our plans are, and certainly get their buy-off on it. So there's kind of that process. I think what we miss in that model is oftentimes we're dealing with folks that are more centrally located and are kind of looking more at big picture items and may not have a full appreciation for what the requirements in the field are. In our model, we actually have a field organization IT group in Asia Pac, and we have one in Europe. But for example, we don't have one in North America, which is a bit odd. So we actually have people that have a business relationship in two regions, but not in our biggest one. And the reason is because we face off with these functional councils and so on locally. I think what we're rethinking now is, who are the customers? How do we get the voices aligned from the field, and how can we help the business in getting alignment from the field? And I'll give you just an example of something that's just a hot button for me is, you know, when we implemented our expense systems, you know, we implemented it to optimize how you manage the receipts centrally. We didn't really ask the field if that was a productivity hit or not for them, but we levied upon them a requirement to do something that they now have to do they didn't have to do before. So we might have optimized for 30 people in a back office, but it really impacted, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people in a very different way in the field. So I think the important thing is, how do you get that? How do you get that alignment? And we're struggling with how to get closer to that. And I think that aligns with what I said before. If you can get closer to the business and the business, real business process requirements, then you can make better decisions around sourcing as well.
Okay, and the second question was, how would you approach trying to get redundancy in software as a service, such as an HR system?
I'm not certain I understand the question.
Well, you know, it's common to not only over-provision, but to have a mirror or a second source or something like that, but it's kind of hard to do with some of those applications.
So if you're talking about what are my, you know, RTO, RPO objectives and service level response time objectives, I think those are all negotiable with your provider.
Yeah, no, I'm saying how do you is it possible to have two providers? One is the standby.
I can't think of why I would want to do that, but you know, if you're thinking about a traditional approach where an IT organization has a set of hardware and somebody like SunGard has it in standby, I think that's a layer below what you want to solve with a SaaS model. You want to hold the SaaS provider accountable for the level of resilience that you need. And however they do it, I mean, I always tell people, you can tell them how to do it, you can tell them how much you're willing to pay, and you can tell them to what level to perform, but you can't tell them all three, right? Because you've just dictated a cost and a set of services that they can't provide for that cost potentially. So when you source, the how is kind of off the table. Does that make sense?
Yep.
I mean, I look at it back to my EDF days. If somebody's outsourced to me, we would want to get them into our consolidated systems as quickly as possible because we could give them a better optimized model with a higher SLA than all the spaghetti factory stuff they had scattered around their data center. So it was better for everybody.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. That was outstanding, Dave Robbins. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and experiences and these actions with us. You really just made our after call a lot more productive, so really appreciate that.
Okay.
I'd also like to thank the other Wikibon folks who contributed to the call today, Nick Allen, Mike Versace, David Floyer. Appreciate it. Just as a reminder, within 24 hours, we'll have these research notes up on Wikibon. With the user actions fleshed out, Dave Robbins will send you folks a copy. Feel free to comment, to hit edit, and improve the pieces if you like. We'll also have a podcast of this session that we'll be sending around. So we're done. Thanks for listening today, everybody, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
See you, Dave.